If it pleases the Court, my name is Charles Talbot. I represent Barbara Nathan, who is appealing the termination of her Social Security disability benefits. Ms. Nathan was found disabled as a result of an accident. She was found disabled in 2004. 3 years later, on a review, the Social Security Administration decided that she had improved her physical health, and so they terminated her benefits. That decision was affirmed by an appeals judge, administrative law judge, and by the lower court. Now, the focus here, at least initially in my argument, is I'm not going to start off with talking about back and forth between what medical evidence should have been accepted or not accepted or how it was interpreted. I'm going to go to sort of the end and focus at least initially on the testimony and the opinion of the vocational expert in this case. In the course of the workup of this case, the state agency folks reviewed some of the evidence in this case, both mental and physical, and came up with restrictions applicable to the to Barbara. Now, the administrative law judge essentially rejected most of the treating medical doctors' opinions in this case and turned to the state agency doctors and their restrictions placed upon the plaintiff, Ms. Nathan, based upon review of the medical records. And the administrative law judge used their Section 3 restrictions to phrase the hypothetical question to the vocational expert to get the testimony that there were several jobs that, based upon that hypothetical question, that Ms. Nathan could do. The problem is that the Section 3 section of the physical evaluation workup that was done by the state agency doctors does not include all of the restrictions found in the Section 1 portion of that workup. Now, when those...
I thought under the guidelines they looked to the Section 3, to the narrative statement by the doctor.
Indeed.
For determining what are the restrictions that are to be applied.
That's true. But here's the problem with certainly the way it was done in this particular case. The Section 1 part of that form is supposed to be a checklist. Basically, what did they find when they went through the medical records? And then the Section 3...
Well, at the end, if you read the explanatory notes from the agency about that form, it's to sort of alert the psychiatrist or psychologist or whoever's doing the doctor, whoever's completing the form, what they need to consider.
Right. The problem is they didn't...
And then they give their little narrative assessment.
Sure. They didn't consider everything. That's the problem. If you take a look at the Section 1 part of the form...
Which one are we talking about here?
All right. We're talking what's found at page 335 in the record.
Hold on.
Now, in 335 in the record, and going over to 336, you'll find that there's seven moderate limitations in that form expressed as far as how Ms. Nathan is limited in her abilities. If you go to the narrative section...
Go to the narrative on...
The narrative's on 337.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay.
If you look at the narrative section, it discusses the fact that she's limited to simple and some complex tasks without interruption from psychiatric symptoms, and she can have brief public contact and may have some difficulty managing change. Those are two descriptors, but there's seven descriptors in the first section, and the vocational expert testified that the most important descriptors in there are the moderate limitations on her ability to complete a normal work day and work week without interruption from her symptoms. I won't read the whole thing. She has moderate limitations to do activities on a schedule and maintain regular attendance, and she's limited to her focus and concentration for extended period. Those are not discussed in the narrative section. And when the vocational counselor was asked the question whether a moderate limitation would be equivalent to a 20% impact on the work ability, she testified that's a reasonable limit. And when these additional limitations were put in the question to the vocational expert, all work activity was precluded. So you can't just read the third section to the exclusion of the first section, because they're both important. And I grant the fact that the rules say, that the POMS say, that the third section is really the narrative portion, but the first section is just as important because it's to be used as a checklist. And you can't ignore Section 1 limitations. You have to discuss them in Section 3. That didn't happen in this case. And when those additional limitations were expressed to the vocational expert, she testified that Ms. Nathan was unable to do any work activity. Now, the other problem in this case...
Just one second before you move on. What were the limitations in Section 1 that were not carried over into Section 3?
Okay.
Or addressed?
If you go for A3, that's the one that says understand and remember detailed instructions. That is included in the RFC question. And same with the B5 limitation to carry out detailed instructions. But when you get to the B6, the B7, the B8 limitations, those are expressed on page 335 of the record. And you go over to B11, which is on the next page. Those are not included in the narrative section. And then the C12, which is the interacting with the general public, that is included in the RFC.
So your argument is that if they check the box, when they get down to their analysis or their functional capacity assessment analysis, having checked any box where it says moderate or whatever, they ought to address it in Section 3?
Absolutely.
I understood the POMS to be that Section 1, and I admit I'm no expert at this. I mean, my goodness. But that Section 1 was only intended to alert the evaluator what to consider, to think about in formulating the assessment.
Well,
not that they necessarily had to.
Remember, it's the same person doing both.
Yes.
This isn't, the Section 1 part of the form is not written by some other individual, which suggests to the reviewer, these are the things you have to look at. The author of the Section 1 part of the form is the same as the author of the Section 3 part of the form.
All right.
So if you sit down and say, I've got these 7 items that are present in this particular case, based on my review of the record, it seems to me that your obligation then in the Section 3 part of the form is to talk about that and not ignore it.
Okay. All right. Got it.
And what they did is they really covered about 3, or the individual doing this report, covered about 3 or 4 out of the 7. And when you have these other significant limitations, and you pose that to the vocational expert, who agrees that a moderate limitation equates to a 20% of the time impact, all work is precluded. Now, the commissioner cites the sample case and says, well, the vocational expert is not qualified to interpret medical information. That's not what happened here. The medical information was interpreted by the state agency folks. Put it down as moderate limitations in the Section 1 part of the form, and all that the vocational expert is doing is simply reviewing what the state agency people undertook. But there's another aspect of this case, too. Understand that a state agency reviewer is somebody who sits in an office and reads papers. They don't have any face-to-face contact with Ms. Nathan. We have a couple of people in here. Dr. Choi, for example, did an examination of Ms. Nathan. He's what's referred to as a DDS reviewer. He is somebody that the Social Security Administration hires to sit down with Ms. Nathan and do a mental workup of her. And he came to some conclusions that significantly interfere with her ability to work, which conclusions were rejected by the ALJ. Now, the ALJ comes up with this notion that she exaggerated or didn't use her best efforts in testing with Dr. Choi when he expressed his mental limitations. And she points to the fact of Ms. Nathan's work history and that somehow that she was a supervisor of 30 people in the course of her work as a CNA. If you look at the earnings records here, it's clear that Ms. Nathan is not a high-function supervisory-type person. She's worked fairly steadily, but her earnings are fairly low, which would indicate work at a fairly low level. And her testimony was she worked as a CNA, which is basically a person that does physical chores in a medical setting. She's not a supervisor. She's never worked at any high level. And there's no support here for the fact that she exaggerated or she didn't use her best efforts in the course of Dr. Choi's assessment. And Dr. Choi was certainly aware and mentioned her work history in the course of his assessment. So he was aware of her background. And Dr. Choi is considered under the rules to be an expert. And Social Security hires Dr. Choi to do an assessment. He writes a report, and the ALJ rejects it. You know, if that's going to be the case, why have the examination done at all if you're not going to use it? So his restrictions are sufficient. Another problem is Ms. Nathan has...
But if your argument is correct, then why even have a hearing at all? You just simply adopt the examiner's findings.
Well, I've been doing this work for 37 years.
Okay.
And I can't tell you how many times in 37 years I have seen state agency doctor assessments where they say, this person is disabled. They have all of these issues. They can't work. We end up in hearings. They ignore these routinely. I don't know why. But we routinely get medical reports, whether they're for physical problems or mental problems, that put very significant limitations on individuals to a degree that even the untrained could say this person cannot work. And they're routinely passed over by the state agency reviewers. I don't have an answer for you why that happens, but I see it a lot.
Did you want to save some time for rebuttal, just in case?
Yes.
Okay, that'd be good.
And I'll shut up if there's any further questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Daphne Benet, appearing for Defendant Appellee, Commissioner of Social Security. With respect to...
Could you pull the mics down a little bit so that we can...
Is that better?
Yeah.
Thank you. With respect to the argument regarding Section 3 of the Mental Residual Functional Capacity Form, a defendant would like to first point out that the argument that Ms. Nathan has made in her reply brief about the mental residual functional capacity assessment in Section 3 not addressing all of the checkbox limitations was not made before this court in Ms. Nathan's opening brief. It wasn't made in the district court, and therefore it should be considered waived. And I've cited authority in our opening brief as to a waiver when issues aren't raised before the district court. In terms of issues not being raised in the opening brief before this court, authority for that is Bray versus Commissioner, 554 F. 3rd, 1219 at 1226 Note 7. Despite the waiver, it's contention it should be held waived, but if the court were to consider this argument, it really doesn't have any merit. And the reason for that is as I understood it, Mr. Talbot was saying in his reply brief that A3 and B5 were not included in the assessment, and from today's argument, I'm understanding that he's now saying that it was. But assuming that he's saying it wasn't, and without waiving our objection, I would note that the assessment here in terms of A3 and B5 were sufficiently accommodated because first, plaintiff provides no support for the suggested argument that some complex tasks do not account for a moderate limitation in A3 or a moderate limitation in carrying out detailed instructions, but in this case, in any event, the ALJ found the claimant more limited as he found that she could perform, understand, remember, perform simple tasks. And this is at ER 21, finding 10. He did not find that she could perform complex tasks. With respect to the moderate...
You mean, in other words, the IJ accounted for that limitation?
Correct. He found her even more limited.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, first, Mr. Talbot doesn't provide any support that even the state agency assessment doesn't account for that, because the assessment is actually understand, remember, perform simple and some complex tasks. So that does account for what the state agency was saying. And in any event, the ALJ found the claimant in this case even more limited. And that finding is at ER 21, finding 10. With respect to the moderate checkbox limitations in B6, 7, and 11, and the contentions that, at least in the reply brief, that they weren't addressed in Section 3, we believe that's also incorrect. Because if you were to read Dr. Collingwood's actual mental residual functional capacity assessment taken together, and this is A, B, C, D, and then the last paragraph here, it indicates as long as Ms. Nathan is limited to understanding, remembering, and performing simple and some complex tasks, she can do so without interruption from psychiatric symptoms. And that's ER 337, Section A and B explanation. And in the last paragraph, Dr. Collingwood said that Ms. Nathan also retains the capacity for productive tasks with noted limitations. With respect to the...
So let me just ask you...
Sure, Your Honor.
No, I don't read these every day.
Mm-hmm.
But in that last paragraph where it talks PER, MER, and ADLs, I guess ADLs is activities of daily living.
That's correct.
MER is?
Medical evidence of record.
Medical evidence of record, and PER?
PER. Just standard from the medical evidence of record, just standard English.
PER.
It's confusing.
PER medical.
Right.
Examination records and activities of daily living, claimant can, mm-hmm. A, B refers to
the, so if you go
1A
back,
and 1B.
Right, if you go to section 1, the A, B refers to category A,
right.
Which is understanding and remembering, and B refers to sustained concentration and persistence.
Right, so she can perform simple and some complex tasks without interruption from psychiatric symptoms.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in terms of, and we raised this in our opening brief too, in terms of the being asked to assume that this means a 20% impact, which, as we pointed out in our opening brief, that's not the definition. That was plaintiff's attorney's assumed limitation.
Mm-hmm.
There is a case from this court that does address this, and the case name is Israel versus Astru. It's an unpublished disposition from October 12, 2012. The citation is 2012 Westlaw 484-5578. I have copies, which I can provide to the court and counsel. And basically, that case is important here. Because first, in that case, the court rejected the type of argument that when a plaintiff's attorney asks the VE to assume an impact for the percentage of time that a claimant would be impacted, the court rejected that argument that a VE at that point is even responding to the checkbox limitations. And what instead the VE is responding is to the claimant's interpretation when the V is asked to assume the claimant will be limited a certain percentage of time. Also, this case is in part because it has In that case, the court rejected the argument that the ALJ has to individually weigh the limitations identified by the non-examining state agency doctrine in each checkbox in Section 1.
Well, but that opinion that you're, that disposition is not precedential.
I understand that, Your Honor. I became aware of this case after I saw my briefing, and I did do research in preparation for this argument, particularly like looking through
papers. It's hard to see how it would lay down a principle that we would have to apply in all cases rather than being just the statement of what happened in that particular case.
I understand, Your Honor. It's just that from my perspective, I looked, and these were the only two cases in the Ninth Circuit addressing it other than the Ornberg case, and Ornberg was consistent in saying, you know, this is not a mental residual function capacity assessment.
So if I understand your position, it's not that it's binding on us, but it's that we should adopt the reasoning used in the case, right?
That's correct.
It's not binding on us. We don't have to adopt it, right?
That's right. Okay. That's right. I mean, two different panels have come to this conclusion, and I think that it's well-reasoned. But,
okay.
I would also like to point out, in terms of the argument that I think of the reply brief about, jumping ahead of myself, I wanted to address the contention about, you know, the ALJ then concluding that based on that the claimant was underperforming and exaggerating. The ALJ just didn't make that statement. He provided the basis for that conclusion, and the ALJ did this at ER 25 through 26, and that was the ALJ based that conclusion based on the treatment records from Cascade Mental Health, and she also based it on the statements to Dr. Gaffield in reaching that conclusion. While plaintiff might disagree with that interpretation, that's not the function of this court on review. And then with respect to the contention of using plaintiff's work history against her, the ALJ explained this also at page 25 through 26, and he did provide support for the conclusion that and this was at ER 138, that Ms. Nathan had reported supervising 30 people. And I would note that under the regulations, even though, and I think Mr. Talbot had pointed out the fact that, you know, these were low earnings, even under the regulations, substantial gainful activity. Work can be considered substantial gainful activity even if there's no pay or profit realized, which certainly wasn't this case. She did earn money. And then, if I may, I would just like to touch on briefly on some points made in the reply brief, because I believe that at least one of the assertions about there not being improvement in medical improvement was based on a citation to an incorrect finding made by the incorrect finding in this case. Let's see if I can find it here. And this was at pages 4 to 5 in the assertion that, you know, as far as the physical abilities, that, you know, there was no increase in her physical abilities. But this assertion is based on a citation of the wrong RFC. On page 5, the finding cited to is at ER 21, finding 10, but the correct medical improvement related to ability to work RFC finding is actually at ER 20, finding 7. And contrary to Mrs. Nathan's assertion, there was medical improvement related to ability to work because there was an increase in the residual functional capacity. And the reason for that is because previously she was found to not even be able to engage in 8-hour-a-day work activity, which is the standard for finding someone not disabled to perform other work in the national economy. And this is at ER 18, finding number 2, where it said that she could stand or walk for less than 2 hours and then sit for 6 hours. That totals less than 8 hours, Your Honor. But if you look at the ALJ's explanation at ER 21, finding 8, he notes that she could stand or walk for 2 hours in an 8-hour day. And she could also, and that she could also walk for 6 hours under the ALJ's medical improvement related to ability to work finding. So there was actually an increase in residual function capacity because the claimant could now do sedentary work. She could now perform work during an 8-hour day. With respect to the waiver issue, I would just say that with regard to the attack on the Edlund panel decision, the court knew what it was doing there. Although it did not cite to a specific case in support of the waiver, it's consistent with the circuit's waiver law. And we know that because another re-judge panel, in which there was a majority of 2 in the Ware case, and that's 439 F3rd 1001 at page 1007, cites to the Edlund case for the proposition about waiver. And I would also note that in terms of this distinction about de novo review, this court has recognized in applying the waiver rule, and this occurred in Edlund, in Macri, in Ware, that that they were reviewing de novo the district court's decision with respect to, you know, the ALJ's decision. But this court has also recognized that it independently reviews de novo the ALJ's decision. And those cases are Tidwell v. Apfel, 161 F3rd 599-601, and Moore v. Commissioner, 278 F3rd 920-924, Ninth Circuit 2002. And I also note, too, that this court itself even applies a waiver rule to at its own level, and that case is Bray, you know, at the same time while it's conducting its own independent de novo review.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let's see, I believe you had, counsel for the appellant had a few minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you. With respect to counsel's argument that we didn't discuss the mental RFC form, the residual functioning capacity form, in our opening brief, you'll find it on page 43 of our opening brief, in both in the text and the footnote, where we discussed at length the fact that there were limitations expressed in the Section 1 part of the mental residual functional form that were seemingly missing from the Section 3 form. And as I said at the outset, I think you have to cover all of them. If there's 7 limitations expressed in Section 1, you have to discuss 7 limitations in Section 3. As far as the review of the other evidence is concerned, the concern we have is it appears that the judge was acting much in the way of a medical expert when rejecting certain evidence, both of a physical nature, particularly from Dr. Deacon, and of a mental nature from Dr. Choi. And these are expert individuals, and the judge is not in a position to take the same facts and data that the doctors are using to come, I think, to a different conclusion. And so I have to rely on their expertise. Now, the impact of their statements is up for the ALJ to assess, but you can't take the same facts and data that the doctors had and arrive at a different conclusion, particularly in view of the fact these doctors are sitting face-to-face with Ms. Nathan, doing an assessment, doing an examination, and writing their report. So unless you believe they're somehow incompetent, I think you have to accept their assessment of the patient. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
both
you.
Counsel, we appreciate your arguments. And the matter will be submitted, and That ends our session for today.
Thank you.